Hello, I'm Lynne Malcolm, and welcome to our Big Ideas Summer of Science on ABC Radio National. Through 2009, panels of experts have gathered together to thrash out some contentious and sometimes mind-bending science, all in front of enthusiastic audiences at festivals and pubs across Australia. Well, now here's your chance to join them. Over the next 5 weeks in our Summer of Science on Big Ideas, we'll walk with the dinosaurs, delve into dengue fever, analyse the minds of psychopaths, and gear up for a trip to Mars. But let's begin today with the possibility that there may be other universes existing in parallel with ours. New theories in physics claim that each of us has many replicas of ourselves in other universes. In theory, you could get in a spaceship and, if you travelled far enough, meet your identical self in an identical world. This Café Scientific event was recorded earlier this year at the Sydney Writers' Festival, and your host is the ABC's Paul Willis.
We're going through the looking glass this afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're going past the outer limits. We're going beyond the twilight zone. We're going to be hanging out at the outskirts of infinity. We are going to have one hell of an adventure exploring parallel universes. And there could be no better Sherpa guides for this particular trip to carry your intellectual baggage than the guys we've assembled for you this afternoon. Please put your hands together for Marcus Chown, Charlie Lineweaver, and David Braddon Mitchell. Now, in case you haven't guessed, talking about multiple universes and why we think they exist is going to get a bit complicated. And I was trying to figure out a suitable way to sort of ease ourselves into this idea that there are other universes out there and that somewhere else there's another Paul Willis who's good looking, you know. So what I'd like to do is I'd like each of the members of the panel to introduce themselves by telling us a bit about what they do in this universe and then talk about their doppelganger in another universe they'd really like to meet and why. Marcus, you're the first cab off the rank. What are you up to at the moment, and who would you most like to meet of yourself in another universe?
Okay, well, my name's Marcus Chown, and I'm a cosmology consultant at the English science magazine New Scientist, and I write popular science books. According to one version of the multiverse idea, there are an infinite number of universes where all possible histories are played out. So I like this idea because, you know, even if my contribution tonight is the worst contribution, I can console myself that in an infinite number of other places in the universe, I was given a standing ovation and everyone went out and bought dozens of copies of my book. So really, it's the doppelgangers in those, my successful doppelgangers in all those other universes that I'd like to meet.
Multiple universes, though, isn't just for covering up for our own goofs in this one, is it?
No. I mean, it's both good and bad, isn't it, really, if such universes exist. I mean, obviously, there are universes where, you know, you have a miserable life. And there's also ones where you're more successful, but presumably there's more where you're more miserable than successful.
Sort of like multi-stream karma, isn't it? You know, I've had a terrible day, but somewhere else I've had a really brilliant day.
Yeah, I mean, there is a famous science fiction story by Larry Niven in which people start committing suicide, and they start committing suicide because they start thinking about all the other copies of themselves in parallel realities who are really having terrible lives. So it becomes too depressing and they all commit suicide.
Charlie, I hope you can give us a happier rendition of the doppelganger of yourself you'd most like to meet. What are you up to these days? You're down in Canberra.
Yes, that's right. I'm a convener of the Planetary Science Institute at Australian National University. What I do research. I'm writing papers on the entropy of the universe and also on whether there might be life on Mars. We just wrote a paper on comparing the sun to other stars to see if there's anything special about our particular sun, to see if there's some type of, special ingredient in the sun that made our existence here possible. The result was no.
And how many ARC grants went into that?
None. And my doubleganger. I mentioned to you earlier that I think that you, Paul, are unique in the universe, even if the universe is infinite, and that, however, comes along with the idea that you are a probability of zero of happening, a set of measures zero in mathematical terms.
This is really comforting. So, thank you, Charlie.
Well, I think that not only about you, but about every member of the audience. And so I'm trying to justify what that means, for example, of whether there is a doubleganger or not. With those assumptions, the answer is no, there isn't. So I don't need to answer your question.
I told you it was going to get complicated, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't even introduced the full panel yet. Last member of the panel, David, you're a University of Sydney School of Philosophy.
That's right. Yeah, I'm a philosopher at the University of Sydney. I do philosophy of science and cognitive science, that kind of thing. I'm afraid I can't take the zero probability answer to the question about my doppelganger, because I don't believe in assigning zero credences. You know, it turns out if you assign a zero credence to something, there's no evidence that could change your mind, according to decision theory. So, yep, there's some tiny probability out there that there's some chap like me, in which case there are probably infinitely many of them. So which one would I like to meet? Well, I think it's the one that plays viola in the concert hall of the world government in Batemans Bay.
I knew that the universes were going to get stranger. I didn't think they were going to get that strange. Marcus, can you paint a picture for us about what we're talking about with multiple universes? Is it possible to, in an accessible way, create that landscape? What are we looking at with multiple universes?
Well, it does appear that nature is banging us over the head and telling us from many different directions that this is not the only universe. I mean, there are many different versions of this idea. You know, I mentioned the idea that there are universes where all possible histories are played out. In fact, that appears to be a prediction of the standard picture of cosmology combined with a standard picture of physics, quantum theory. Then there is evidence that there's a multiverse with universes with different laws of physics. You know, there could be universes with different numbers of dimensions. And at the moment, you know, we don't know how all these separate ideas mesh together. This is an emerging picture, and, you know, if you're confused by the idea of the multiverse, so is everybody else. You know, it's not really emerged yet as a picture.
But is this the sort of a cosmic foam of bubbles of different universes side by side, stacked on top of each other? Or are they sort of parallel to each other so that the next universe is just a little bit over there from where I'm sitting?
Kind of both, really. The thing you need to know about parallel universes is they're neither parallel nor universes. I mean, that was... I think Douglas Adams said something like that, which was, you know, probably true. But in a trivial way, we can only see the objects whose light has had time to get here. The universe was born in the Big Bang about 14 billion years ago, so we can only see the objects whose light has taken less than 14 billion years to get here. Objects whose light would take 15 billion years to get here, well, its light is still on its way. So our universe is bounded by a horizon. You know, we call it the observable universe, but the horizon is very much like the horizon at sea. You know, just as we know there's more of the ocean over the horizon, there's more of the universe over the horizon. And according to the standard picture, which incorporates an idea called inflation, there's an infinite amount of the universe beyond the horizon. So if you imagine our observable universe as kind of a soap bubble, then there's an infinite number of other soap bubbles beyond. And they all, well, they all have big bangs. The seeds of galaxies which were seeded in those big bangs would be slightly different, so they'd have different distributions of stars and galaxies. And as I said in the opening, the universe is actually quantum. So the, you know, space you can imagine as a chessboard. So if you imagine the seeds which led to galaxies as bits of matter on squares of a chessboard, just as there are only a limited or a finite number of arrangements of chess pieces on a chessboard, there are only a finite number of places you could put those seeds. So there are only a finite number of arrangements of matter that you could have in the universe, a finite number of histories, yet there are an infinite number of places where they can happen, you know, an infinite number of these bubbles. So in other words, every single history happens not once, but an infinite number of times. So, you know, there are universes that contain copies of you, and I can even tell you, if I could remember, there is actually a distance to your nearest doppelganger, the nearest universe, which is identical to ours. So, and nearest one of these bubbles. God, that was a long, complicated answer, wasn't it?
Is he being paid more than I am? That's what I'm curious about. Charlie, can you unpack this a bit for us? These multiple universes, what's the origin of them?
Well, we have only vague notions about the origin of our universe, so we can extrapolate those to these other ones fairly confidently. And say, I mean that, actually. Let me explain in what sense I mean that. There are a group of people in the world called quantum cosmologists, and they study the origin of our universe. And one thing that's common that seems everybody agrees with is that when we get very early, 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the Big Bang, which is called the Planck time, that general relativity ceases to be valid, and we need some kind of new theory, a combination of quantum mechanics and general relativity, to talk about something even earlier. And John Archibald Wheeler talks about space-time foam, and we can talk about scalar potentials, and when inflation happened, we're not quite sure. But what everybody seems to agree on is we need some general relativity and quantum mechanics to talk about it. And if you need quantum mechanics to talk about our universe, the origin of our universe, one thing that quantum mechanics does tell us is that quantum mechanics doesn't deal with single events. It deals with distribution of events. And if that's the case, that suggests, I think, very strongly that other universes were created at the same time as ours. Where that might have happened or how you describe it, we have really difficult time with it. But the fact, the idea that, hey, this didn't just happen once, our theories, our best theories, the quantum cosmological theories about the origin of our universe, suggest very strongly that this is not the only show in town.
Okay, but I've read that or seen in some presentations that essentially multiple universes is a solution to the search for the unified theory of everything. That in a way, when you try and unite quantum mechanics and general relativity, the very small and the very large, one of the consequences is multiple universes. Is that true?
Where'd you hear that?
It was on YouTube.
I've heard that multiple universes is a explanation for why this particular universe seems to be well-fitted for life. Now, this is something that Paul Davies and many other people talk about. Wow, look at if the ratio of the mass of the electron to the mass of the proton were changed by some small fraction. And Martin Rees always talks about this as well. Change these ratios, these dimensionless constants, by some small fraction, 1% or 0.1%, then we wouldn't have atoms, or gravity would be weaker. Or, in other words, in our minds, or in their minds, they are letting all kinds of things vary. And I'm not sure that we should let these things vary. Some of them, it might make sense to vary. Like, you know, if I pour the water on the table, some drops will go here, some drops will go there. And if I did it again, they'd go in different places. But when you talk about the speed of light, you know, it's not obvious that if you reduce the speed of light by, you know, 1% or something, that that would have any effect on our existence or not. Changing the ratio of the electron to proton mass probably would, and I agree. But who says that that's something that's reasonable to think about being different? That it's not obvious to me. And I guess mathematical cosmologists like to play with these ideas, but even though I like to speculate, I like to constrain my speculation. Although I see lots of evidence for the quantum nature of other universes, I don't see any evidence for the evidence we have suggests that this could have been different. I don't see any evidence for that at all. And so I'm reluctant to imagine things where there's no evidence suggesting that it's okay to imagine that.
Okay, so there are limits on practical imagination, might be one way of summarizing.
Or useful, or scientific useful imagination. Okay. I think scientific imagination should be constrained to what is suggested by data.
Okay, moving along to David. David, we've assigned you the task of trying to explain the three different ways that we actually end up coming to the idea of multiple universes.
Yeah, I think when people talk about multiple universes and their doppelgangers and so forth, they're often talking about a bunch of very different sort of hypotheses about how things might be. So one of them is the one we've heard so far, the hypothesis according to which there might be entirely other universes, perhaps not connected in space or time to this one, perhaps connected to it at black holes, but there are other, as it were, complete universes in which there might be all these things happening. But there are two other, of course, things people are often talking about. One of them is the evolution of the actual universe on one of the interpretations, and very controversial which one is right, if any, of quantum mechanics. So if you believe the so-called many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, what you think happens is that every time there's something probabilistic going on, rather than one thing happening and the rest not happen, the universe splits and all of the things happen. In which case, every time you do something in your life, then the universe splits into different versions, if it like, according to which you did the one thing, you came to this session or you didn't come to this session. And so they're your doppelgangers, if this is right, within the actual universe. So that's a second way in which you might talk about doppelgangers or worry about multiple universes. The third is not actually so much multiple universes, but there's some controversy about the geometry of space and time. But on one, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, plausible interpretation, it might turn out that the actual universe, the one around us, is spatially infinite and homogeneous. So there are galaxies out the wazoo, and infinitely many of them. So it's not like you have doppelgangers in other universes, but at certain directions in the actual universe, you'll keep on going long enough, and everything which has non-zero probability will happen. So you'll find a planet just like this one, except that, you know, the Nazis won, or people who look like Nazis, they're not Nazis, won the war.
That's David Braddon Mitchell, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Sydney, on our Cafe Scientific panel with UK writer Marcus Chown and astrophysicist from the ANU, Charlie Lineweaver. You're listening to Big Ideas Summer of Science on ABC Radio National, and we're exploring the science of parallel universes. Now, back to our host, Paul Willis.
When you start talking about things like in quantum mechanics, because it's probabilistic, and so therefore one thing happens in this universe, but then the possibility of all the other outcomes occurring, to me that sounds like a mathematical fudge. And it sounds like we're talking beyond science. We're not really talking within the realms of something. Well, I mean, what's your control group for an experiment like that? You need to invent another universe to find out if this one exists.
You are going to propose a control group. I am going to tell you an experiment we can all perform, which will find out which interpretation of quantum mechanics is right.
Go on.
Okay, here's how it goes. If this interpretation is right, then every time something happens, which has some probability, all of the possible things actually happen in some branch, including the extremely unlikely ones. So suppose you're in a car and you're driving down the road and you have a massive car crash, which is almost impossible to survive. In some branch of the universe, you survive. Then as you crawl away, crippled, and you go to hospital, some terrible thing happens which has got a very low probability of your surviving. In one of the branches, you survive. If you find yourself, Paul, in 200 years, still alive, having survived endless near-death experiences while everyone else around you has not survived them, then you should be pretty confident that the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics is true.
You're putting me up as a control group?
Well, all of us.
There is actually a more immediate experiment, and it was proposed by Max Tegmark at MIT. I think he was someone you were a student with, Charlie. But he envisioned a thing called a quantum machine gun. And you stand in front of this quantum machine gun, and it kind of comes to fire a bullet, or it jams, dependent on a quantum event, which is kind of like a quantum coin flip. So, you know, an atom can be measured, I don't know, spinning one way with a 50% chance, spinning the other way with 50% chance. And on the basis of that, it either fires or it jams. If the many worlds is correct, and you stand in front of this quantum machine gun, every time it comes to fire, it will jam. Because you cannot actually perceive in universes where you're dead. So you will continue to perceive in the branches of the multiverse where you're alive. And after about a hundred, you would hear this machine gun jam 100 times, 1,000 times, 2,000 times, and you'll step out and you'll realise that the many worlds is correct. Unfortunately, in most universes, your family and friends will see you die. And even in the universe where you've survived, most people just think you're lucky.
Think of it as quantum Russian roulette. If someone offers you really good odds in a game of quantum Russian roulette, then this theory says, take the money.
I mean, the interesting thing about the many worlds...
Can I meet you guys at Star Casino later on?
I should say, the many worlds is one of about 13 possible interpretations of quantum theory. Okay, and all of them predict the same outcome in every conceivable experiment.
Can you give me an idea of what you mean by 13 different outcomes? Okay, so what are some of the other outcomes?
Well, the basic problem we have with quantum theory is it describes the microscopic world of atoms and their constituents, and they can do bizarre things. You know, they can be in many places at once. Atoms can communicate with each other instantaneously, even when on separate sides of the universe. But, of course, when you put a lot of atoms together to make you, you know, you can't do any of these things. So we have to explain why, you know, the everyday world is completely different from the microscopic world. In one of the early interpretations, which hardly anyone believes now, is the Copenhagen interpretation. And that says that when somebody observes an atom or whatever, you know, the act of observation, the act of measurement, in some way prevents the atom being quantum. It prevents it being in many places at once, makes it behave. Okay, but that artificially divides the world into, you know, the microscopic world that's a quantum world, and, you know, the other world, our world, which is not quantum. So that's kind of not very good as a universal theory.
That's Heisenberg's uncertainty.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay, as a universal theory, you'd expect to apply everywhere. Interesting, in many worlds is another interpretation, and in some sense it's more economical, because what it actually says is that quantum theory applies to everything. Absolutely everything, not just the microscopic world. So in other words, you know, you're in many places at once. You know, there are all these kind of doppelgangers. So in a way, it's more economical at the expense of creating an infinite number of other universes. So, you know, there are another 11 interpretations of quantum theory. In many ways, they're kind of equivalent. But I've now forgotten what the original question I was answering was.
I love it when the answers are so fascinating, you just get lost in them.
Why did you say infinite number of other universes? I thought previously you talked about a chessboard where we had a finite number of quantum states.
Yeah, what I was talking here about in many worlds is an interpretation of quantum theory. I mean, we're talking about quantum events here. So if there's, for instance, a single event that triggers a cancer in you, for instance, I don't know, a bit of ionizing radiation hits a bit of DNA, then that's a quantum event. So it both happens and doesn't happen simultaneously. According to the many worlds, the universe splits into a universe where you get cancer, and a universe where you don't. Probably because you can only perceive in the universes where you survive, you'll always live on, and you may be immortal. So that's the quantum version. But when I was talking about the universes beyond the horizon, where all possible histories happen, and Charlie just points out, because of the finite nature of space-time, there are only a finite number of histories, that's kind of a slightly different idea. It's a more concrete idea because we actually believe these universes or these domains of our universe are real. And if you go in that direction, a certain number of billion light years, you will come to your doppelganger. Whereas the many worlds interpretation is just one of 13 interpretations of quantum theory. But what I would say is either the universe has these quantum many worlds, either there are these multiple universes, or it behaves as if there are these multiple universes. So you pick one of the two. And most physicists would pick the more conservative version, and they would say that the universe behaves as if there are multiple universes.
Sounds like there's some cosmic practical joker out there.
Well, I mean, there is a physicist called David Deutsch who says that we really got to accept the many worlds, and he points to the quantum computer. And the quantum computer is a device which exploits the quantum ability of an atom to be in many places at once, to do many calculations at once.
And this is a device that's yet to be invented.
Well, it's a bizarre object because we know a lot about it and we haven't actually built one yet. But to make something quantum, to behave in a quantum way, quantum theory is not a theory of small objects, it's a theory of isolated objects. So it's easy to isolate an atom, so it behaves from its surroundings, so it's a quantum thing. Very hard to isolate you, you know. But if I isolated you from your surroundings, at a moment there are air molecules bouncing off you, light bouncing off you. If I isolated you from your surroundings completely, you would behave like a quantum object and could do many things at once. And this is the idea of a quantum computer. If we isolate it, put it, you know, build this thing in a vacuum chamber, cool it to minus 270 degrees, it would behave, it's a big thing, it would behave like a quantum thing. And Deutsch says, although the most complex, we haven't really built a quantum computer, but we've built kind of devices that behave a bit like quantum computers. The most we can manipulate is about 10 binary bits. Well, you know, your computer can manipulate megabits, gigabits. So they're very primitive. But we can imagine, in 10 to 20 years, a quantum computer being built that can do more calculations simultaneously than there are particles in the universe. Then you have to ask yourself the question, where is the computer doing the calculations? And David Deutsch at Oxford says, it's actually doing the calculations in multiple realities. You set the quantum computer a problem, it splits into copies of itself in parallel realities, they all work on separate threads of the problem, and they come together with the answer.
So, one question.
Can I just take a straw poll here before we go any further? Hands up, all three of you actually accept this, the multi-universe is, that it's a reality?
Which one? The quantum
which
version?
One? Yeah, which one?
Which one of them? So we're talking about a plethora of multi-universes,
yes,
of course.
Yes.
Of course.
Well, I think most of us agree that if the universe is infinite spatially, and it looks like it is, then there are regions of the universe beyond our observable universe, and that's not much of a stretch of imagination. What they are like, I just assume they're just like ours. Other people say, well, maybe they have different constants, but that's one way in which we have parallel universes. Like, you know, they're kind of vertically parallel. Here's our observable.
I vote for that.
I think most people accept that. But there are a few people who don't, because we shouldn't even think about things beyond our observable universe because we'll never know about them, etc.
One question is, which of these things is true? And another question is, which we should hope to be true? And if there's one I hope desperately is false, it's the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics.
I agree.
Because that predicts...
I don't hope anything. I'm a scientist. I don't hope.
Well,
In another universe, I'm not a scientist,
and I do hope, because what it predicts is an infinity of pain.
Yeah, because what's happiness?
Wouldn't you also have an infinity of happiness?
No, it's rather more pain.
Why infinite pain and no happiness?
Here's the problem. The problem is every time one of those events happens where there's a low probability of surviving, right? Most of your branches, you end up dead. But the only ones in which you're perceiving are the ones where you survive. But in which proportion of the ones where you survive do you survive unscathed? A very small proportion. In most of the branches where you survive either maimed or miserable or damaged badly. As you get older, you keep on surviving. There's a branch in which you survive these ever more unpleasant events, in which you emerge at the end ever more damaged, ever more crippled, just enough to be able to perceive your raw pain and survival.
But surely
your friends and family are dead. Life's bloody miserable, this is right.
But surely you survive in the universes where we discover how to download our consciousness into computers and that kind of stuff. Become immortal.
Well, yes, that's the hope. But unfortunately, there may be rather fewer, so we have to put a measure over these branches.
I think that's misguided. And I think that because we are all here as a result of thousands and thousands and thousands of other organisms that have died. I mean, that's exactly how natural selection works. And I wouldn't suggest that natural selection produces a bunch of miserable life forms.
Unfortunately, I don't think that's right. Firstly, it's very unclear that happiness did anything for your survival. The point is that the number of branches in which there are these incredibly long surviving things is a minute proportion of the total.
Just like us, all of our ancestors. I mean, we are the result of the fortunate ones who survived,
sure,
right? And there have been lots of things that have died.
Looking from the outside at all the branches and seeing the fact that, you know, there aren't long-survived, miserable people in most of them is no consolation if you're in one of the very few in which you are a massively over-survived, crippled sort of replica of your past self.
Over-survived, crippled replica.
Why do you didn't want to meet your doppelganger?
Wow.
Let's just hope it's not true.
Can I just say, if we're going to continue the conversation and you keep saying you with respect to, like, me... could we just, for the rest of it, my friend Tibor's in the audience, can we pick on Tibor?
In
multiple universes,
you
suffering immense pain, is Tibor. Tibor Mol, ladies and gentlemen, give him a big round of applause.
Stand
please.
Up, Tibor.
He's going to be our guinea pig from here on in.
But it is a worry, you know, if all these universes exist, then why defeat Nazism, you know, if it survives in an infinite number of universes? Why try and fight for good if misery is going to occur in most branches? But of course, the answer to that really is that we have to worry about our own universe, you know. I mean, we've got to solve global warming in our own universe, and we can't really worry about all the others.
I'd like to trim this tree of multiple universes a little bit.
Please, and take the Black and Decker. I want this one pruned.
Now, you say all possible universes as if that means something. I think that statement doesn't mean something for the following reason. You know, I can imagine, for example, that another universe, I don't know, I'm 27,000 feet tall and my nose goes around my head 3 times and then goes into here, goes through here, and then I use it as a dagger to kill some giant. I mean, I can imagine all kinds of crap. And it's very important that not necessarily be considered one version of the multiverse. For example, when you say there are many versions of the universe in which the Nazis win, matter of fact, there are more of them or something, I'm asking, now, why does he think that's plausible? I mean, every time somebody says, oh, if frogs had wings or if Adolf Hitler didn't have a mustache or had half a mustache, I'm saying, Is that something that we should consider as a quantum event that could lead to that? And I'm not convinced that there are quantum events that could lead to me with a nose 27,000 light years long that I use to, you know, drink water out of, that is made out of, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I can imagine crap, yeah. And it's not scientific. And so you have to trim these branches and ask, what version, what fraction of what I can imagine could have been the result of these quantum events that we should imagine in the multiverse. Not all of them.
I do agree with you, because, I mean, we have to, as I pointed out, you have to be careful that we're talking about, if we're talking about many worlds, we're talking about quantum events. So, you know, it isn't simply that all possible histories happen. These have to be things which are caused by single quantum events. And that's why I picked cancer, which could, in some circumstances, be caused by a single quantum event. And therefore, you would both get cancer and not get cancer. So you have to be careful about, yeah, you're absolutely right, you prune down those universes. But if we're talking about the type of multiverse that we all agreed on, which is that beyond the horizon of our universe or other universes, where the seeds of galaxies were different, where different stars formed and different planets and maybe different life arose, then, you know, maybe that it is possible to get that person with the nose that goes three times around their head.
What possible application or good does it do us to think about there being multiple universes? I mean, is there actually any applicability to thinking about multiple universes?
I think so. As a physicist, for example, although many of my colleagues as cosmologists think, oh, that's crap, you know, one universe at a time.
There's a lot to be getting on with.
Well, in some sense, physics is the study of what remains constant. We have laws and conservation laws of energy and angular momentum and linear momentum. And we'd like to know, well, if we have a law, we want it to be valid for all time. If we find a law that changes with time, then we have a new law that describes the changes of that law. So what good is it? It's good because we have a value of light of certain speed, right? We have a value of the cosmological constant in our universe, which is a certain value. We have these ratios. We have about 26 or more constants in physics that we use, and we would like an answer to the question, could it have been different? And this is what, you know, Einstein tried to say when he said, I don't know, I don't know these details. I just want to know if God was playing dice or not. Could the universe that we live in have been different? And we don't know that, and we're trying to figure it out. And thinking about multiverses helps us think, well, it could have been this, it could have been this. Could the vacuum energy, for example, be a billion times larger than it is? And they say, well, we have an anthropic reason why that couldn't be, because if it were, then the universe would accelerate so much that we wouldn't be here to, we wouldn't be observers. So we have to have anthropic constraints on these imagined probability distributions, which may not exist anyway. So it's interesting to wave your hands and get us thinking laterally. You know, we scientists sometimes think in ruts.
I mean, people do object to the multiverse for kind of emotional reasons. You know, they think, what an incredible waste, you know. But I think, you know, all these infinite numbers of universes, many of which probably don't have life, you know, what?
That's not necessarily a waste.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm just saying that is a human emotional response, and it's not a scientific response. You know, we have to accept really what nature tells us. And all the indications are the universe keeps getting bigger and we keep getting smaller. I mean, you know, if you take a few hundred years ago, we thought the universe was just the sun and a few planets. By the beginning of the 20th century, we realized that the sun was part of the Milky Way, a giant collection of stars of maybe 100 billion stars. Later in the 20th century, we realized that the Milky Way was one among 100 billion galaxies. And now we're realizing that there could be an infinite number of universes. So it does seem as if we're getting smaller and smaller, and that's what nature is actually telling us. And you would think, why does nature need so many universes? But then again, if you take a star, I mean, nature has the model of a star, and it's repeated it endless quadrillion times. There are 100,000 million in our own galaxy, there's all these 100 billion galaxies. Why does nature need to repeat this pattern endlessly? Maybe it repeats the pattern of universes as well.
I think that one of the practical applications of this stuff is that it has a real effect on our ethical thinking in a strange way. There's a theory in ethics called consequentialism, of which, you know, utilitarianism, of which many of you have heard, is a pretty standard example. And the idea there is that the right thing to do is the thing which increases the amount of good of some kind. In the crudest version, it's just happiness. What you should do is you should do whatever generates more happiness in the universe and avoid doing whatever would have less happiness. And what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to be a universalist. You're supposed to say, we care about people in Africa, even though Africa is a long way away, because being a long way away is beside the point. What matters is the total amount of happiness there is in the world.
Human species.
Well, no, happiness in the world. I mean, in the universe, indeed. I don't think we think that, you know, higher apes should be excluded from the count if they are sentient beings, which probably they are.
How about lesser apes?
Maybe. Who knows? Anyway, there's a boundary somewhere. But of course, one of the strange things, well, maybe there is. I don't care about cockroaches. I poison them happily.
We're not talking about the happiness of cockroaches. They'll have the last laugh, won't they?
So if the universe is spatially infinite, and if there are infinitely many conscious beings out there, then the total amount of happiness and of pain is infinite. It's infinite happiness, it's infinite pain. There's nothing you can do to increase it. There's nothing you can do to decrease it. And so that account of ethics, which I'm actually very attracted to, would tell you that it doesn't matter what you do. It makes no difference what you do to the total balance of pleasure and pain, of beauty and ugliness, of anything in the universe. So you're going to have to do something to get out of this. I mean, you could retreat to some other ethical theory, or you could say, well, actually, it does matter. I don't care about those suffering doppelgangers, zillions of light years in that direction, because that's a long way away. But then we're back to that kind of ethical thinking we had once, where being a long way away mattered. And zillions of light years, tens of thousands of kilometres, it's, you know,
in another
it's just
forum,
distance.
In another forum one day, David, I'll have to get you talking about the global financial crisis and the budget. I'm sure that there are much nicer ways of viewing it than the current situation.
MacBank is rich in one of those worlds.
Philosopher David Braddon Mitchell. And with him on the panel are UK writer Marcus Chown and astrophysicist Charlie Lineweaver. You're listening to our Big Ideas Summer of Science on ABC Radio National, and we're grappling with the science of parallel universes at a Sydney Writers' Festival event recorded earlier this year. Our host, Paul Willis, is taking questions from the audience.
My question's kind of to what Charlie was talking about. You're talking about how everything's infinite, and essentially there's an infinite probability that anything can happen. So doesn't that kind of rule out anything having a probability of zero?
No, I mean, it is difficult to get your head around something called a set of measures zero or something of zero probability. But I think it's as simple as the following. Instead of thinking of me or Paul, just think of one electron that's in my nose.
Or Tibor.
Or Tibor. That Tibor, you have an electron in your nose. And we're trying to figure out where exactly is this electron. I mean, we could define Tibor as some region of parameter space where, you know, if he's got three arms and that's still Tibor, if his head is the same or something. But let's just talk about something specific, like the way he is now. And let's say, okay, he's got an electron in his nose. Where exactly is it? Now, we have something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, delta x delta times delta p is greater than h bar, which means the uncertainty in the position, our measured position of that electron, if we use high energy, we can figure out where it is pretty precisely, but then, boom, its momentum is very big, and the sum of those delta x and delta p is greater than h bar. But the question is, you have an electron there. Do I need an infinite precision to describe its position or not? If I do need an infinite number of digits to describe it, then you are that electron and every other particle in your body is a set of measure zero. In other words, what does it mean to talk about that electron somewhere else, that exact electron? I mean, first of all, you need a framework and say, okay, this framework is the same, and between these two boundary conditions, that electron is exactly, you know, infinite number of exactlies in the same place. I mean, quantum mechanics does not say that the electron could be here. Some people think the smallest interval of space is something like a jiffy, or that's time, but 10 to the minus 35 centimeters is the smallest interval of space. But it's not obvious to me that that electron, when it's moving like this, goes from one to the other without passing through something in between. It's a very difficult interpretational problem, and based on those difficulties, I think we shouldn't necessarily assume that you are not a set of measure zero. It may be just an electron, it might be a set of measure zero.
Does anyone have any Panadol? another question from the floor.
You talked about the double slit experiment as an example of communication between two possible universes. How do we recognize something strange that's happening in our universe as a being rather than an example of something that demonstrates communication between two different universes? How do we recognize the difference between something strange happening in our universe that we just don't know how to describe yet?
Well, I mean, as I say, the many worlds is just one interpretation. It's one way of explaining why you see that interference pattern, which requires two things to mingle, even though only one thing has actually gone through that opaque screen. And so that is one interpretation. I mean, you know, there are 12 other ways of interpreting it as well. The incredible thing is they're pretty indistinguishable. I mean, they seem to be indistinguishable, so you can pick whatever explanation you like and still get the same outcome to all experiments.
Well, that's not necessarily the case in the sense that you can say, well, it interferes somehow with itself in ways that we don't know. So that's kind of like what you say. It behaves strangely. Well, we can wave our hands and say it interferes with itself somehow. And then you don't need multiple universes to...
Well, you can say that it does go through both slits simultaneously in our universe, which, of course, is what we often say. An atom can be in two places at once.
Yes. Nothing wrong with that. That doesn't necessarily mean you need a multiverse to...
No, absolutely. As I say, you know, the universe, you know, either there is this multiverse or the universe behaves as if there is this multiverse. I mean, Occam's razor would actually say you choose the simplest, which is there is a multiverse. But in some sense, that's simpler, but it actually creates a whole proliferation of universes. So it's all these things are incredibly difficult to define, aren't they?
Okay, another question.
I have two very basic questions for the panel, nothing erudite at all. You've all spoken about practical imagination as well as impractical imagination. If you go right back to when you first became interested in your respective subjects, maybe as a child, do you think a child can actually have an idea before they're educated that gives them some insight? One of the reasons I ask this is that I remember at the age of 9 asking my father, how did we know that there wasn't another universe 60 seconds ahead of us or 60 seconds behind? And the look on his face is why I remember this question. And I got a set of Arthur Meese children's encyclopedias for my 10th birthday saying, here, read these.
If only your dad could see you now.
I'm not a scientist at all, but I'm extremely interested in what you're discussing. And the second question is probably for David to say, do you think, after discussion with the other members of the panel, that, as Charlie said, getting more and more information and knowledge about over the horizon of universes, is the universe trying to tell us something about, could we please look more towards the philosophical attitude towards science?
Yeah, I mean, can I just say that, I mean, and children can accidentally ask incredibly profound questions. I've noticed it. I did a children's event here with 5 to 10-year-olds today, and they ask quite profound questions as well. And having that kind of childlike ability to ask questions is very important. And a person who epitomised that was Albert Einstein, who really didn't go to any of his lectures at all and kind of taught himself physics from papers, scientific papers that he read. And he retained that kind of childlike, you know, ability to look at the world. And he asked himself incredibly simple questions, you know, like what was it like to ride on a light beam and all that kind of stuff, from which relativity came. So, yeah, it's very, very important to have that kind of childlike view of the world.
I think what scientists and philosophers are is frozen 11-year-olds. There's that wonderful time when you're about 11, when you care about all these things, when your imagination is kind of unbounded by the practical, and you're trying to get it, and you're trying to build a picture of the world, and somehow or other it goes away, and some people remain a kind of, you know, psychically 11 forever, and it's bad in some respects, but it's fantastic in others.
And David, the second part of that question was, is there a philosophical compulsion to...
The second part of the question was, is the universe trying to tell us stuff?
Yeah.
No. But I think we should tell ourselves exactly that.
Do you guys sleep well at night? Sorry, another question here.
I'm a hypnotherapist, past life regressionist, and I don't know whether you're familiar with the work of Professor John Mack. For those who don't know, he was a Harvard psychiatrist who dignified the past life experience and the what was previously called alien abduction. He renamed it experience. To what extent do you think the experience of alien abduction might be explained by moving into other universes or crossover between universes?
I think this might be one for you too.
I was about to say the same thing actually, Marcus.
Well done, they're all ducking for cover. If I may extend the question, when we raise the topic of multiple universes, there are other areas of human interest. Ghosts and spiritualism and, as the lady said, past life regressions and alien abductions that people invoke, that maybe parallel universes are somehow involved. What's your take on that?
I do think about things like precognition. I mean, most people have the experience sometimes that they heard something before, they're re-experiencing something. And, you know, it does make me think about parallel universes, you know, and I do wonder, is there a parallel universe, for instance, where we had this panel discussion yesterday And maybe there is some communication between parallel realities or something, and that's where we get this concept of precognition. But, I mean, it's unlikely to be true, but I just thought I'd speculate on it.
I'm pretty sure the neuropsychology of deja vu has actually been figured out, so we can rule out the parallel universe.
Deja vu, I've heard that
deja
before.
Deja vu. Oh.
All right, the last question from the floor couldn't be from a more fitting questioner, being Tibor, our multi-cosmic guinea pig. Tibor.
Charlie, earlier in the presentation you said that the universe looks as if, or it looks to us as if the universe is infinite. Now, you also said, out of the other side of your mouth, that you can't see beyond the event horizon, you can't see beyond 13.7 billion light years. In that case, how does infinity look? Now, there's a supplementary part to this. I guess one could be forgiven for saying that you can always make it up. And that brings up a third thing that you said about how there are certain things that you just don't think are reasonable to imagine and other things are reasonable to imagine. By what criterion can we decide what it is reasonable and unreasonable to imagine?
Well, imagine yourself on a boat and you're in the, I don't know, middle of the Pacific Ocean. And let's suppose that you had a very good tool to measure the curvature of the universe. I mean, sometimes when I'm in the plane and I look at the horizon, I say, oh, can I see the curvature of the Earth? And then I look at these pictures from the space station. I say, oh, wow, that's curved. They can see it, and I can just barely see it. So picture yourself on this boat, and you're saying, well, am I on an ocean that's infinite and goes on forever flat, or am I on an ocean that's curved? And if you measure that very, very, very precisely, you can tell the difference between, let's say, an ocean on Mars where you have this kind of curvature, ocean on the Earth where you have this kind of curvature, or an ocean on an infinite planet or a flat planet that has no curvature at all. We do an analogous thing when we look at the microwave background radiation, and we can tell that to within the precision we can measure, the universe is consistent with being spatially flat. Now, that means the horizon that we see is spatially flat. But notice that even on a boat, you look at your horizon and say, ah, you know what? It is consistent with being flat, and therefore it makes sense to imagine that there are places beyond the horizon that I can see. That's part of the reasoning. People try to figure out, well, how closed is the universe? And people say, well, it's at least 3 times the size of the observable universe. And maybe it's with this next satellite that just got launched last week, the Planck satellite, we can tell that with a little bit more precision. And so then we say, well, the entire universe, is at least 10 times bigger than the observable universe. But the data is consistent with it being spatially infinite, and it might always be the case, but maybe not. Maybe sometime we'll get such high precision that we can say, ah, we found the curvature of this inflationary bubble, and it is closed, but its radius is 253 times the observable universe. So that's one way to...
Charlie just mentioned the Big Bang radiation, the afterglow of the Big Bang, interestingly, there might be some proof that the existence of other universes in that radiation. It was 99.9% of the light of the photons in the universe were actually tied up in the heat of the Big Bang. Because the Big Bang happened in the universe and it was bottled up in the universe and there was nowhere for that heat to go, it's still around us today. If you tune your television between the stations, something like 1% of the static you see on the screen is microwaves which have come from the Big Bang. We can't see this radiation because it's not visible to the naked eye. But if we had eyes that could pick up microwaves rather than visible light, and we looked at the night sky, it would be glowing from horizon to horizon. It would be as if we were inside a giant light bulb. But we can see kind of variations in this brightness, and they correspond to material beginning to clump very shortly after the Big Bang, about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. And we've seen... And it's relevant to you in the Southern Hemisphere, an anomalously large hotspot in the Southern Hemisphere. It's bigger than anything that the standard Big Bang theory predicts. And we're not sure that it really exists yet. I mean, Charlie will probably know more about this. But in the standard picture of how our universe formed, we have what we call an inflationary vacuum, which was a high-energy vacuum, which has repulsive gravity and which inflates or expands. And all over this vast sea of vacuum, bubbles form occasionally, randomly, where the vacuum decays. And inside these bubbles are Big Bang universes. And we are one of these bubbles in this great ocean. So you could conceive that when our bubble formed, our bubble Big Bang universe, and the other ones formed nearby, and maybe they collided with each other before they separated, and that would have left an imprint on the background radiation, the afterglow of the Big Bang. And it could be that this anomalously hot, large hotspot in the Southern Hemisphere is the imprint of a collision of our universe with another universe.
Look, it's time to wind up. And given that, although the idea of parallel universes has been around for some time, it's really only in the last decade or so that they've started to be taken seriously, and people have been thinking about some of the evidences that you've been talking about and ways of investigating the idea of parallel universes. So it's only a young area of science. Where does its future lie? What if we had this discussion in 10 years' time, or in the universe that's 10 years in advance of ours, what are they talking about when it comes to parallel universes? Marcus? How's the science going to develop?
I'm not sure how fast it's going to develop. Personally, I think that some version of this idea is going to be accepted, even though emotionally, well, we find it very hard. The universe is already big. To imagine it's even bigger, maybe infinite, it's very, very hard to get our head around. But I do think that nature is banging us over the head and telling us from many directions, different directions, that there is more than one universe. So I do think that it will be accepted and it will be mainstream maybe in 10, 20 years.
Can you see, Charlie, how the theory would develop? Are there sorts of various landmarks we need to achieve for its acceptance?
Well, there's one rule in science, and that is you need evidence for something. And I think the evidence, although you say it's banging us over the head, I think it's banging me on the side of the head, or very lightly, and it's interesting, it's tickling, it's getting me to think outside the box, and that's what scientists appreciate, unless you get too far outside the box, and then you get, you know, the Nazis winning World War II. But I don't think we should play the game of speculation, because science will follow the evidence. If we find evidence, for example, from the radio waves and the gamma rays that I mentioned earlier, for multiple dimensions, oh, there'll be 10%, 20%, 50% more people looking into that type. Ah, can we interpret it a different way? Or what have you. Now that we've found vacuum energy, we're going to have a lot more people studying nothing. That is the... And I think that's very, very important, because you and I, these baryons, that, you know, we're just 4.4% of the universe, and we're kind of negligible when it comes to the energy density. We need a lot more people looking at what is a vacuum, how can it possibly change phase, and we need evidence. And as long as an idea doesn't have good testable predictions, then it kind of floats around, and we have discussions like this about it. But tomorrow, if there's somebody, hey, this is a testable prediction, I made that test, it was really hard, but I did it, and it suggests, usually indirectly, that this is a good model, then you'll have more people. And it's a little like a snowball effect, and who knows where that piece of evidence will come from, but we keep looking.
David, the future of multiple universe science, can you see some evidence potentially on the horizon?
It's a bit like financial management, really. If I knew the answers to that, we wouldn't have to do science. But if this were a pub quiz, I guess I'd say, yeah, I think we'll find that in textbooks in 10 years' time, something like at least two of the three different kinds of multiple universes we've been talking about are generally accepted, but who knows? It depends where the evidence goes and how the interpretation goes.
One answer is that is the person in the boat. You have a person on the boat on the ocean, and you see swells of different sizes. You see swells that are this big, swells are this big, and essentially you have a power spectrum of swells. How much power is at this wavelength versus this wavelength versus this wavelength? And then you have a whole pattern, and then you say, huh, what happens at wavelengths that are larger than my horizon? And so what I do when I do data analysis, I always like to extrapolate one bin further, and that one bin further is outside the event horizon, outside the observable universe. And maybe, for example, well, we have a background radiation that's 2.7 degrees. Well, maybe over there in another observable universe, it's 2.8. Maybe over there it's 10,000 degrees. But the size of the swells within our universe can help us figure out what the variations of the temperature might be beyond the horizon. So you're using what we see here to extrapolate. We see waves that are this big, and we say, ah, if I extrapolate that to longer wavelengths, I get some variation over here, and I can predict what's beyond the horizon based on this principle. Yeah.
So we've done our bit for science here, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Look, I told you it was going to be a wild ride, but... And I'm not sure how many of you managed to hang on to that Bronco that we just rode for the last hour and a half, but it's been absolutely fascinating, and it wouldn't have happened without the three brilliant minds on the stage. Please put your hands together for Marcus Chown, Charlie Lineweaver, and David Braddon Mitchell.
ABC TV's Paul Willis hosted this Cafe Scientific event, which was produced by Abby Thomas for the Sydney Writers' Festival earlier this year. Panelists were David Braddon Mitchell, Professor of Philosophy at Sydney University, Marcus Chown, UK science writer and broadcaster, and astrophysicist from the Planetary Science Institute at the ANU, Charlie Lineweaver. Thanks to sound engineer Michelle Goldsworthy. I'm Lynne Malcolm, and I hope you can join me next week on our Big Ideas Summer of Science when we delve into the science of the psychopath, guided by the writer of the Dexter series of fiction books. It's intriguing. That's Big Ideas next week. Bye for now.